based on a simple and old idea. So if you have a big object, if you have an object that you mechanically suspend, you're automatically susceptible to many sources of noise. Among other things, thermal, vibrational, etc. In the 70s, Ashkin at Bell Labs, Ashkin and his group, but at Bell Labs, had this idea to get rid of the mechanical suspension and hold the object with light. That automatically created a very well-isolated system. It automatically isolated the center of mass motion from the internal vibrational degrees of freedom, and it also, the object is no longer thermal contact in its environment. If this object is a dielectric and you hold it close to an extremum of the, to the minimum of the potential, then you see that there is a force that's proportional to the gradient of the electric field squared, and for small displacement around the equilibrium position, you find that that force is a restoring force. So what you have created is a designer harmonic oscillator. For that harmonic oscillator, because of the very good isolation, the quality factor, which is nothing else but the ratio between the mechanical vibrational frequency and the loss rate, can be larger than 10 to the 12, even at room temperature. To give you some idea of how big this number, how important this number is, the best mechanical oscillators right now have quality factor of just up to 10 to the 6, roughly. As I've already said, because now the soil, if it's a small object, the frequency of the internal vibrational modes has nothing to do with the center of the trapping frequency of the center of mass motion. So you've automatically reduced the vibrational background. At the same time, because you hold the object with light, in particular with lasers that you can control very well, you have great control of the center of mass motion of the object. And recently, in the past 5 years, there have been several proposals that suggest that such an object, if trapped, trapped by light, can be cooled to the ground state of motion. Yes? Yes. You have to average over the period of oscillation, because the frequency of that change is in the 10 to the 15 hertz or so. You're looking at motions that are a kilohertz, let's say. So you have to average over a period of oscillation for the light, and then you find that the force scales like that. It would be sitting at an antinode. So you need a maximum of the intensity. You need a maximum of the intensity to get a minimum of the force. So not a node is a maximum gradient. So there, it's not an equilibrium position. So you need to sit at an antinode. So you need a maximum of the intensity. A node will be a maximum gradient of the intensity. It's a node is where the intensity goes to zero. But, I mean, you need to sit at the maximum of the intensity. Yes, so by adjusting the intensity, you control the trapping frequency, because the trapping frequency, as you can see here from the force, it's proportional to E squared, and E squared is the intensity. So the force, your spring constant, is automatically proportional to the intensity. As I will discuss later, you can also use the laser to cool the center of mass motion. So these techniques have been used not only for macroscopic objects that I will be talking about, but they've been used in a variety of scales. They've been used for atoms. So they gave rise, these techniques by Ashkin, they gave rise to the field of atom interferometry that has flourished in the past 20 years. They've been routinely used as optical tweezers in biology to move around proteins. And lately, they found great applications in quantum computing. And in particular, the last field is worth mentioning that there's been great strides in the latest years that where people have tried to create the biggest cuts, quantum cuts possible. So this is a plot. So this is a plot that so if you have a trapped oscillator, an oscillator, you know that its energy is quantized in units of the fundamental frequency. So this is a plot that shows the occupation number of a trapped oscillator as a function of the trapping frequency. I should say this is a plot that summarizes these results that does not only include optical techniques that involve optical cooling. But as you can see, in the past decade or so, there has been great strides, and there are several groups that have managed to obtain states that have less, that the states for these oscillators that have less than one thermal quantum. And in particular, it's worth pointing out that in 2010, a group in Santa Barbara, the Cleland group, has managed to cool an object of roughly 100 microns in size down to the ground state of motion. They've also coupled it to a transistor, to a small squid, and they saw the oscillation essentially between ground and excited state. So they've demonstrated that you can put a 10 to the 9 atoms in a superposition of states and have quantum behavior. The main, one of the very important ingredients of manipulating objects with light is optical cooling. And the way to understand how this works for big objects is it's good to start with the smallest ones, the atoms. And for atoms, you can think of it as Doppler cooling. So let's take an atom that has a fundamental excitation frequency of omega atom, what I call omega atom. And let's shine a laser on it that's ready tuned, that has frequency less than a nominal excitation frequency of the atom. Because of the Doppler effect, the atom can only absorb that photon if the laser is counterpropagating. So if it does that, it absorbs the photon, slows down, and finds itself in the excited state. Later on, after a while, it will re-emit this photon by spontaneous emission. And this photon now will be re-emitted at the nominal frequency, at the nominal excitation frequency. So during this process, the atom has absorbed the photon of less energy than it has emitted. So it finds itself with less kinetic energy than at what it started with. So this is what is called Doppler cooling. Now, you can think about a similar effect happening for an object trapped inside a cavity. Now, if you have for this system, you can think about the excitation energy of the system, what was omega atom before, is set by the resonant frequency of the cavity, omega cavity. The kinetic energy of the atom is substituted by the energy of the trapped oscillator. And now, if you shine a ready-tuned laser in the cavity, a laser that has less energy than the nominal resonant energy of the cavity, you'll see that the only way the oscillator can absorb the photon is by, at the same time, reducing its vibrational energy in the trap. Later on, the object will re-emit the photon, but it will re-emit it in the only energy that's available to the system, and that's the frequency, the resonant frequency of the cavity. So again, your oscillator has absorbed less energy than it has emitted, so it finds itself with less energy in the trap. So now, given this technique, you can use this to you can use optical cooling as well as trapping objects with light to test short distances of gravity, to detect gravitational waves. And finally, I will talk about how you can potentially use these techniques to create macroscopic Schrödinger cast states. The short distance tests of gravity are motivated by many theories, as many of you know. I like large extra dimensions, supersymmetry that predict very light fields that have roughly a range, a Compton wavelength of roughly a millimeter. And these are experiments that have been happening for the past 15 years or so. In these experiments, you look at the force between two test masses. Is there a pointer somewhere? My laptop pointer doesn't work in this mode. It's okay. So in this experiment, you take a small test mass, and that's attached to a cantilever, so it has a resonant frequency. And below it, what you have, what you see here, a drive mass that's oscillating. Now the drive mass, now what they do is they look at the amplitude of the test mass vibration as a function of the distance between the test mass and the drive mass. And they usually place bound on deviations of 1 over R square law for the force, for the Newton force, in terms of the potential, what they usually express their results is by looking for a Yukawa force, something that has a strength alpha relative to gravity and a range lambda, and that is exponentially with the distance. So in these experiments, you do a similar thing. You trap a test mass close to a drive mass. Now the trap, there is no cantilever arm, and you use what you see in black, a laser in black, to trap an object close to a surface that acts like a wall of your cavity. Behind the wall, you have a test mass that oscillates at the resonant frequency of the system. So now, again, you look at the amplitude of the oscillation as a function of the distance. Because this system is very well isolated, you can get force sensitivities that are down to 10 to the minus 21 Newton per root hertz. The current best cantilever experiments are at frequencies of 10 to the minus 28 Newton, 10 to the minus 18 Newton per root hertz. And the reason is that the sensitivity is proportional to the square root of the quality factor. So you get huge improvements by the 6 orders of magnitude improvement in quality factor. And this is a plot that summarizes the results. This is the strength of the force in the y-axis. You see the strength of the force relative to gravity as a function of the force range in the x-axis. The yellow region is what's already been excluded by cantilever and the torsion balance experiment. And the curves denoted by A and B are two different setups of these experiments. And as you can see, for the region roughly below 1 micron, you get an improvement of roughly 6 orders of magnitude compared to current bounds. So this is a huge improvement. And I should say, this is something that's currently been built by my experimental collaborator, Andrew Geraci, and hopefully he will have results soon. This is what is predicted, yes. Going to gravitational wave detection, as you all know, gravitational waves are the last piece of general relativity that we haven't seen yet. You expect them to be around, of course. We expect tons of sources to come from ordinary astrophysics, from standard model physics, in spirals of black holes. We also expect to have beyond the standard model sources coming from the early universe, inflation, bubble collisions, string theory, phase transitions, many things. I should say that these are actually very exciting times because Advanced LIGO is supposed to start running in a year, in early 2014, and it promises to be the first experiment to actually detect gravitational radiation. So the experiment I'm going to be talking about operates at higher frequency than LIGO, operates at frequencies between 10 and 100 kilohertz. The setup is the following. So you have a cavity of size L in which you trap a small object. That object can be a sphere of radius 150 nanometers, or a disk that has a thickness of or a disk that has a thickness 500 nanometers and a radius 75 microns. The size of the cavity I'm going to consider is roughly between 10 to 100 meters. You trap the object in one of the antinodes of the laser light inside the cavity, and you also need another laser to cool the motion, as well as another laser to cool the motion of the object, as well as another laser to measure the position of the object inside the cavity. The way a gravitational wave works is, let's imagine that you have a gravitational wave that propagates perpendicular to the axis of the cavity. It stretches the space between the two mirrors. And it changes the physical distance between rest masses of your experiment. So it will change the physical distance between the two end mirrors, as well as the physical distance between the input mirror and your sensor. So you have, in order to take into account the full effect of the gravitational wave, you have to take the account both on the effect of the gravitational wave, both on the sphere and the end mirror, if you measure with respect to the input mirror. So first of all, if you change the physical distance between the two mirrors, what you do is you shift the position of the antinode, of the maximum of the intensity, by an amount that's proportional to the change in the length. H is the amplitude of the gravitational wave, and L is the size of the cavity. Yes? Yes, you need some rudimentary vibrational isolation, but because you work at much higher frequency than LIGO, it doesn't have to be as perfect, but you do need some vibrational isolation. They do need to be essentially free-falling test masses. So this is the next one. No, you will still have an effect if you hold it at a stiff setup. The problem is that the vibrational noise will be different. Because very stiff, then the response of the system to vibration is different. And you do need some rudimentary suppression of the vibrations. So it's better to have it freely suspended. If the resonant frequency is very high, the response in the amplitude is flat, and then it drops with frequency above the resonant frequency. This is how LIGO, the resonant frequency, for example, of trapping frequency of LIGO mirrors is like in a few hertz region. So for those mirrors, so till then, though, the response is flat, then you get a resonant enhancement of the vibrational noise at the nominal frequency, and it draws like F squared. So it's better to be in the F squared regime than having a flat response to vibrational noise. So the other thing that the system does, the gravitational wave does, it changes the physical distance between the input mirror and the sensor by an amount, again, that's proportional to the amplitude of the gravitational wave times the position of the sphere. So, but what you measure in this experiment is the difference between the sphere and its equilibrium position. So what you care about is the difference of these two numbers. So what you find is actually now that the signal is still proportional to the amplitude of the gravitational wave. It goes to zero if you put the sensor close to the end mirror, and it maximizes if you put it close to the input mirror. And now because you can tune, so now if the frequency of your gravitational wave matches the trapping frequency, you have a resonant enhancement of the motion of the sensor. And since you can change the trapping frequency, you can scan at different frequencies for gravitational waves. So this is kind of, this setup is a tunable gravitational wave detector. Again, the sensitivity, as you can see from this formula here, and also here, the sensitivity in the gravitational wave amplitude improves with the size of the experiment. And it also gains a lot. It improves by the square root of the quality factor. So you can reach roughly 10 to the minus 22 per square root hertz sensitivities for a disk that's trapped in 100 meter cavities for frequencies that are roughly above 30 kilohertz. And as you can see, since the temperature, this temperature here is the temperature of the center of mass motion. And this is exactly what limits the sensitivity of this experiment. So the main background here, in contrast to LIGO, is the thermal motion of the object in the trap, not any shot noise coming from the laser itself. Because the signal is resonantly enhanced, the minimum displacement you have to be sensitive to is roughly 10 to the minus 15 meters per root hertz. At LIGO, this number is 10 to the minus 18 meters per root hertz. So you get a huge boost from that. And this is the same thing in a graphic representation. This is Yes, so that determines also the optimal size. So as you can see here in this formula, the sensitivity improves with the mass. So the bigger the object, the better. But at some point, though, you hit a roadblock. There are two things. First of all, you always want the width to be smaller than the wavelength of light, so that you're close to the point particle approximation inside the trap, because you're trapping it in a lambda, in a region that's lambda over 2. So the wavelength that I'm talking about is 1.5 microns for the laser. The other thing is that as you make the object bigger, it gets flabbier. In a sense, now the internal vibrational modes, their frequency drops. So at some point, it starts getting into the 100 kilohertz regime. So then you have to worry about how the internal vibrational modes affect the center of mass motion. And for the object that we are discussing, this is not an issue. For the size that we're discussing, this is not an issue. So this is a plot that summarizes this. Yeah? Yes, it is heated by the laser. So this is true. So you cannot really reduce that. But again, it improves with the mass, and also it improves with the shape. And you can see this here. So this upper plot here, this is sensitivity of the experiment as a function of frequency. This upper blue dotted line here is for a sphere in a 10-meter cavity. The sphere is 100 nanometers in size. And the bottom, and you see now, this is at around 10 to the minus 16 per root hertz. Not, it's good sensitivity, but not great. Now, if you put a disk inside the cavity, either in a 10-meter cavity or a 100-meter cavity, you get a drastic improvement in sensitivity. And this is because of two reasons. First of all, this object is bigger, so it just the thermal noise is smaller. But it turns out, because you have the disk geometry, you have the, what you say, scattering from the light. This is ordinary Rayleigh scattering. And it turns out that for the disk geometry, most of the scattering is the forward direction. So that means you don't change the momentum of the object that you scatter from. So it turns out you get a small boost from that. But again, if you start increasing the frequency, at some point this will come in here. For the sphere, the main limitation is actually that. It's not the thermal motions. The heating is not the initial temperature of the object. It's just heating from scattering from the photons of the laser. So you can see now again that you get roughly 10 to the minus 22 sensitivity from a region of 30 kilohertz down to 300 kilohertz. And this is how the sensitivity compares to LIGO and advanced LIGO. So the solid line is current LIGO. And the dotted line, red dotted line, is what is projected for advanced LIGO. The overall shape is a sensitivity that drops with increasing frequency, linearly with the frequency. And the main reason for this is the response of the LIGO detector to gravitational wave. Because at those high frequencies, the wavelength of the gravitational wave is smaller than the size of LIGO. So just decoupling comes in. At some point, you don't expect the oscillation averages out. But ever so often, you get this resonant enhancement in sensitivity. This is what is called the FSR regime, this pre-spectral range regime, where the gravitational wave wavelength is an integer. The length of LIGO is an integer multiple of the gravitational wave wavelength. So every time the photon bounces back and forth, it sees the mirror in phase. So you get a resonant enhancement of the signal. As you can see, the setup with a 100-meter cavity matches the LIGO sensitivity at around 30 to 40 kilohertz, and it can be more than a factor of 10 better at higher frequency. And this is great because LIGO is a 4-kilometer cavity, while the experiment I'm talking about is 40 times smaller, which means you can build it in a lab. Yes? Yeah, 4 Kelvin is the temperature in the trap. And as you can see, at some point, it doesn't make much difference. Than 30 Kelvin, because then you start limiting by photon scattering from the laser. Oh, it's a, this is a room temperature, the top. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. So you exactly. So you have to scan. Mhm. Yeah. Yeah, they're very narrow resonances, some of them. So you have to have, experimentally, they're much harder experiments to do. You have to tune like a big room of chunk of, yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, but you have to cool them. You have to have a dilution fridge that's of that size. So these, so these are room temperatures. The experiments that I'm talking about are room temperature. You don't need a huge dilution fridge to have this enclosed in. Ah, so the Weber bars are somewhere here. They're a bit worse, but not that much. I think that was my impression. So for this curve. Yeah. Exactly. How long does it take? Good. Excellent question. So if you naively had a quality factor of 10 to the 12, in order to settle down, you have to wait a huge time, right? 10 to the 12 times the period. But the good thing is that because of the cooling, you use an optical cooling, which is active all the time, that optical cooling reduces the effective Q down by a factor of 10 to the 9. So the effective Q of these oscillators is 10 to the 3. And the key thing is that because of the cooling, you also reduce the effective temperature. So the point is that T, the initial T over Q is equal roughly to T effective over Q effective after cooling. So because actually the Q effective is not that high, you can scan reliably without having to wait for a long time. Yeah. So Q effective, so let's say for a, if you are at 10 kilohertz and you have a Q effective of, let's say 10 to the 4, 1 second. That's okay, right? No, it doesn't change the response to the gravitational wave. The reason is because the trapping light, it doesn't, as long as it doesn't do anything to the equilibrium position, I mean, the light, both the, what is the best way to explain this? The effect of the gravitational wave, you can think about it in a reference frame as coming solely from the rest masses. So it's not, as long as it's not affected, it will, because, so I should say that the power, the relative fraction of power of the cooling light relative to the holding light is like 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7. So it's much lower power that's inside. So in principle, it does shift the equilibrium position by a bit, but not much to affect the, any way the measuring, the effect of the gravitational wave. This is a plot, this is a table that does a more direct comparison with LIGO. So as I said, the main source of noise at those high frequencies is the thermal motion of the sensor in the trap, or the motion that the motion that comes from scattering of light outside the cavity. While for LIGO, you have to worry about laser shot noise. The displacement sensitivity in this experiment that you need to detect a gravitation wave up to 10 to the minus 22 per root hertz, you need to get sensitivity of position measurement of roughly at 1 femtometer, while at LIGO is 3 orders of magnitude smaller, what you require to get. As I've already said, because, first of all, because the object is small, the internal vibrational frequency is higher, the internal vibration frequency of the internal modes is higher than the trapping frequency, so they decouple. But also, because the object is sub-wavelength in size, it acts mostly as a refractive object instead of a reflective object. So I should say that in LIGO, even at those high frequencies, you have to worry about the surface vibration. But in this experiment, we've actually calculated this, and we find to be a factor of 20 smaller than the sensitivity that we got. So now the question is, what sources do you expect to see? And for astrophysical sources, you expect to have, there is a natural bound. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It is. The problem is that you no, it's not. Because, so, turns out that the overall power is roughly the same. But the problem is the following. In order to get this high trapping frequency, is there a shock? Ah, there we go. Okay, great. So in LIGO, because you want, so in LIGO, the way the beam looks like is something that looks like this, over 4 kilometers. Okay. In our setup, the way the beam should look like is something that looks like this. And you trap it here. So you have to focus it down. So the waist, so you have the same power, but the waist size is a few centimeters in LIGO. Similar powers, but in our experiment, this waist is 75 microns here, close to the mirror. So in principle, you could design LIGO, but you need to refocus the beam of light in order to be able to bounce back at 4 kilometers without having to make this mirror something like 100 meters, the end mirror. 100 meters? Yes, it's possible to refocus. But we haven't thought about it, and in all honesty, I don't think it will help much in sensitivity. And the reason is that cavities have a natural response time that's set by the travel time of the photons inside the cavity, so which is the finesse times the size of the of your experiment, roughly. So if you have a four, so at that point, then after that, if you go to shorter time scales, the response of the cavity gets suppressed because it doesn't react that fast. So if you go to 4 kilometers, at those high frequencies, you get this additional suppression, this because of the cavity response. And in principle, if you have, let's say, the point is that you can have, at some point, you don't gain that much. By going, but in principle, you could design a refocusing system that does it. But you have to now consider what happens to the light every time it goes through one of these lenses. So you have to consider, so in principle, there are additional sources of noise. It's not necessarily impossible, but I also don't think it's maybe necessary. Yeah, I mean, you get a little, it is less efficient, you get more susceptible to noise coming from each of the lenses you scatter from you. Going back to sources, now, so there is an upper bound on the frequency of astrophysical sources that comes from what is the smallest size astrophysical object you can have that has strong gravity. So if you take that to be one solar mass black hole, you get something, the frequency that's 30 kilohertz. So you don't expect many astrophysical sources, roughly, say, above 100 kilohertz. But turns out that that there is an interesting, beyond the standard model physics source, there are others that I won't mention here. There are others that come from string theory, maybe inflation. But what I will mention here is one that comes from can come from astrophysical black holes and the effect of black hole superradiance. So this is an effect, the superradiance effect is also known as the Penrose process. This is something that has been known for a long time. And it happens for rotating black holes. So if you have a rotating black hole, it has a region around it called the Ergo region where even light has to rotate. So if you take a light pulse, and you shoot it through the Ergo region, but not through the horizon of the black hole, the wave packet, the electromagnetic wave pulse, will come out with higher amplitude than what it came in. But the frequency, the overall frequency will be the same. So in this process, during this process, you have extracted energy and angular momentum from the black hole. In the 70s, Bresson and Tucholsky imagined the following experiment, the following amusing experiment. Let's do the same experiment now with a light pulse, electromagnetic wave, but let's surround the black hole with a perfectly spherical mirror. Now, if you do that, the electromagnetic wave bounces back and forth many times. And eventually, it grows. The sample grows exponentially. Eventually, it will hit the mirror, and the mirror will explode. So this is what they call the black hole bomb. Of course, we cannot do this for astrophysical. We cannot construct such mirrors for astrophysical black holes. But luckily enough, there may be objects in our universe that act like mirrors. And that is massive bosons. So if you have a particle, a boson, that whose Compton wavelength that has a mass, and whose Compton wavelength is roughly the size of the black hole, it can create a bound state with a black hole. So its mass acts like a mirror, and this massive boson will leak into the ergo region. Its amplitude will start growing, and will create a cloud of bosons around the black hole, while at the same time the black hole spins down. This object looks very much like a gravitational atom in the sky, because unless you sit very close to the black hole, the potential that this cloud sees is a 1 over r potential, is a Newtonian potential. So this gravitational atom can be characterized similar to the hydrogen atom by a fine structure constant. That's now said by the G Newton, the Newton's constant times the black hole mass times the mass of the boson that's bound to the black hole. The binding, again, the states, since it's hydrogen atom states, they are characterized by the principal, the orbital, and the magnetic quantum numbers. And the energy is just inversely proportional, roughly, to the inverse quantum number and proportional to the fine structure constant squared. But there's one major difference compared. Mu here is the mass of the, what I call the mass of the boson that bounds. It's the mass of the particle that does the binding. So the main difference between the hydrogen atom and this atom, is the gravitational atom, is that instead of fermions, instead of electrons occupying these levels, you have bosons. And the occupation numbers for each of the levels, instead of just 2 or 1, can be as high as 10 to the 75. So you can have this, even though this mass of the boson is very small because its Compton wavelength is large, has to be a kilometer, this can carry a large fraction of the momentum and the mass of the black hole. So you can have interesting effects coming from it. And the interesting fact, and I should say though now that I should stress that super radiance is not a resonant effect. It's a kinematic effect. Yes? Background? Yes, they do. So what they do is, the way they found out the solutions, first of all, they took the Kerr metric, they put a massive scalar field in the Kerr background, and they found that you get these bound state solutions with an imaginary part of the energy. Most of them are decaying, but there are some that are growing, that are instabilities. This is the end state of the instability. The end state of the instability, at some point, it's not stable. We can discuss it in more detail later, because these are excited levels. Eventually, they will decay to a level that's the bosons that occupy those levels will decay to a level by gravity wave emission to a level that's unstable, and they will fall back into the black hole. So the end state, because this rate, though it's very small, the end state is the black hole with nothing around it, but the cloud can live for a very long time around the black hole. That's the point. Yes, it has to be very weakly interacting. Yeah. I will come back to that. Yeah, that's an excellent point. That actually gives rise to interesting effects, even the small interactions. So I'll come back to that. The point is that since it's a kinematic effect, there is a kinematic condition for this to occur. So you require that the total energy of the field, I call it here an axion, that occupies that state is less than the magnetic quantum number of the state times this omega plus, which you can think of as nothing else but the angular velocity of the black hole. And this is given by this, this omega plus is given by this formula. A is the spin of the black hole and can take values from 0 to 1. This is a very complicated formula, but you can imagine there is a very nice particle picture behind it. So if you have a rotating cylinder and you scatter an object tangentially through the to the cylinder, in order for the object to come out with higher momentum than it came in, it has to have a velocity, tangent velocity, smaller than the rotational velocity of the cylinder. So it's a similar condition here. What you care about now is how fast this effect happens. It turns out the time scale, the fastest it can be is 10 to the 7 times the infall time into the black hole, the size of the black hole. And even though this seems like a very small time scale, if you should, for a stellar mass black hole, this is a time scale of roughly 100 seconds. The dynamical evolution time scale for astrophysical black holes is the accretion rate, which is 10 to the 8 years. So this times this effect, even though naively you think, oh, it must be very tuned, it actually, because astrophysical black holes are actually quite stable objects, it has a lot of time to evolve and to affect the black hole dynamics. And as you might expect, if the Compton wavelength of the particle becomes much smaller than the black hole size, this rate is exponentially suppressed. While if the particle mass becomes much, the Compton wavelength becomes much larger than the black hole size, then it varies like a very large power law. So the particle, No, it's actually, you can think of it as a tunneling effect. It's because the potential, so if you look in some tortoise coordinates, it's called some coordinate system, the potential, this is the black hole horizon, and this is, let's say, infinity. So the potential looks something like this. There's an angle. So this is the ergo region. And this is where you have the bound state of the particle. This is, let's say, the wave function. So what you care about is the leakage of the wave function inside the ergo region. So you naturally expect this to be suppressed because there is the angular momentum barrier. In other words, if this were not here, the particle would just fall into the black hole. As it happens for states that are non-rotating at all, that have no angular momentum, they are totally unstable, and very quickly so. So the particle, this is going very slow. The particle that's best motivated to create this effect comes from the strong CP problem in the standard model. Turns out that the standard model is an additional term you can write whose effects are parameterized by an angle, the QCD angle. This term is CP violating, and it predicts that the neutron must have a very large electric dipole moment. And of course, we've looked for it, and we find that actually the electric dipole moment of the neutron is 10 orders of magnitude, at least 10 orders of, it's constrained to be 10 orders of magnitude smaller than what is actually expected. So you need to solve this problem, and one nice solution is to turn this angle into a dynamical field, what is called the axion. It gets its mass from QCD effects, and that mass turns out to be very small. So there's another parameter that characterizes its properties, the axion decay constant. And for an axion that has a relative axion decay constant of 10 to the 17, that Compton wavelength is roughly 3 kilometers. So it matches, the size of astrophysical black holes, of solar mass black holes. So in order to think about how this stability evolves, first of all, you care about its rate. you care about what affects the black hole dynamics, particularly the accretion time. But since this is very high, we ignore it for the rest of the discussion. You care about the particle self interactions. If they are too high, they can actually impede superradiance. And also you expect thickness-thick signals. Because this is a quantum state that's created around the black hole, you can have gravity wave transitions between different levels of the gravitational atom, and you get monochromatic gravitational wave radiation. And also because the axion is its own antiparticle, you can have two axion annihilations to one graviton with the black hole, the black hole nucleus, making sure that energy and momentum are conserved. And this is the signal that will be most interesting for what I'm talking about. So, well, I guess I should go faster because I've only have 40 cities, like 10, 15 minutes. What? You have a question, okay? Yeah. What do you mean, phase? But it's very coherent. Ah. How would it cohere? Because it's not interacting with anything. It's like a laser source. It's very narrow. And it's because it's set by the decay width of the line, right? So it's like an atomic line that you observe, and that's not affected by anything that does in the propagation. So it actually remains very coherent in its propagation throughout the universe. And the reason that it remains very coherent is because you start off from a very coherent state. The point is that this process creates particles in exactly the same state. So you have a particle Bose-Einstein condensate around the black hole. No, so yeah, that's the interesting thing. So it turns out because the black holes are excellent vacuum cleaners, so the accretion disk, you can calculate how much roughly mass there is in the accretion disk, and it's much, much smaller. That it's a much, much smaller perturbation than what the rate would imply. Sorry? Yeah, but that evolution is pretty slow. No, but it's a single, I don't understand your point because, see, they may change in time, but the transition time scale, I mean, there's a transition time scale for this thing to go from one level to the other. While this happens, it's set by the occupation number is very high. So each state is coherent. I don't understand how this dephasing can occur. It's not the same as in spirals. They won't interfere with, you're worried about interfering with things that were there before? You emit a gravitational wave, and then bam, comes another one with different frequency that you decohere with. No, but the spread, this line width is huge, tiny. It's tiny, so for these effects. So So, yeah, exactly. They're perfect. These are like very cool lasers. No, this is going to be just one line probably at a time. It's not going to be many lines. The point is that each time, I should go much faster actually, because, yeah, that's very small. Yes, at some point it will change. It will change the line. Most of the time is though irrelevant. It can affect the evolution. So what it will do, the most important thing it will do, at some point the self-interactions can become so large that they dominate over the gravitational interaction, the gravitational binding energy. They will make the cloud collapse. So they will stop in superradiance. So this effect actually works for very, very weakly interacting actions, whose action decaying constant is actually quite close to the Planck scale or a GATT scale. If you have an action decaying constant of 10 to the 12, maybe you won't superradiate because the self interactions impede you. I don't have time to discuss about this actually now. So I should move very quickly. The point is that at each moment in time, you only have one superradiance level occupied, because the time scale between different levels is so different for the evolution. So what you'd expect to happen is at each point in time, you have one level that's superradiating for black holes. This is spin versus mass. And then what you expect to happen is the black hole to be going down in jumps while its mass doesn't change much. And eventually you will stop superradiating, where the time scale becomes longer than your dynamical evolution, either the accretion time scale or the age of the universe. So this is what I was talking about the effect of self-interactions. When the self-interactions become of order the trapping energy, what happens is you get this effect called the bosonova that people have observed in the lab. And this limits your cloud to be a fraction of proportional to the ratio between the action decay constant over the Planck scale squared. It's worth pointing out that people have measured spins and black hole masses already, and it already constrains the action parameter space. So for the QCD action right now, there is roughly an upper bound on the QCD action decay constant that's roughly 10 to the 17 GeV, from the observation of spin and masses of black holes. So presumably by observing more and measuring more spin and black holes, you can observe QCD action down to a decay constant of a few times 10 to the 16 GeV. So for the experiment that I'm talking about, again, the relevant thing is the action annihilation to one graviton. Here, the graviton mass is set by twice, the graviton frequency is set by twice the axion mass. And it turns out for the QCD action that has a decay constant around the GATT scale, this frequency is roughly 145 kilohertz, which is the sweet spot for the experiment that I just described. And the size of the signal you expect in H is roughly for a size of the cloud relative to the black hole of 10 to the minus 3, you get an amplitude of H of 10 to the minus 22 for an object that's within our galaxy. And this is a plot that shows this. Again, now here is some signal sensitivity in square root hertz as a function of frequency. And this is the signal you expect from the QCD axion. If the distance to the source is within essentially 10 kiloparsecs, which is something that's an object that's within our galaxy. I haven't plotted below here because this is already, I consider this already excluded from black hole observations. And this is where the GATT scale QCD action lies, which is kind of the, again, the sweet spot for our experiment. Yeah. 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 So the point is, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you. I'll tell you. Yes. So I'll tell you what it happens. Turns out for it's very important. So that actually what you say happens. So if you have levels that have different angular momentum, okay, different L, they can be, they can, so if you have, let's say, in the jumps that I was talking about, roughly, let's say, at each jump, the L, the state that has the minimum L superradiates. So you stop superradiating at some point when you no longer satisfy the superradiance condition. And then at that point, you are left with a cloud around the black hole that has a certain angular momentum. Now, what wants to grow is the higher angular momentum level. But that level, because of what you say, because of the mixing between the levels, because you already have a level with certain angular momentum, does not let the other, there is level mixing. So the L plus one level that was supposed to be growing does not. So actually, the only way you can have viable superradiance with many levels occupied simultaneously are levels that have the same angular momentum. And the reason is these levels do mix at some point, but not much, but they do not disturb the superradiance rate because they have the same, because essentially they have the same shape. So what you say is important. Yeah. Yeah, this. Yeah, the transition rate. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but why? Yeah. It's not much. It's not much. It doesn't affect the effect as much as you think. It's very small mixing. Yeah. Say that again, sorry. Why should it be coherent? I don't understand. Those interactions are not, they're very suppressed. They are not as important as the gravitational interactions. That's the bottom line. So even though the effect that I was talking about, the mixing between different states, what affects the coherence is gravitation interaction. The self interactions are not that important. I assume, no, I do not assume that, but the point is that most of the time, the gravitational interactions are much stronger because of the strength of the gravitational field that the axions occupy and the black hole binding energy. There is not, that's very small, because... Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now you say
but it's a different thing to say that there is a spread than to say there is a shift. There could be a shift in energy, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it causes decoherence. Even a line width does not cause decoherence. A laser has a line width. Yeah, yeah.
And so you can have lots of possible conditions. So now you put 10% of that in what you
It's one state. Right? Most of the time is
one particle approximation first, right?
Yeah.
So is it just going to stay with
one state?
Or there will be a spread in the energy level?
There may be. No, no. Yeah, yeah.
Then square of that of pair interactions, right? So I'm not convinced that it would not lead to the spread of the light. I don't know.
I don't think so. We can discuss this later if you want, okay? Okay, yeah. The action field is a few. Oh, it's theta over f action. It's a fraction of that, usually. FA over FA, you mean? Yeah, so this is 10 to the minus 2 or something of that. Yeah. Yeah, so why do you think it will cause a decay of the state? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying nothing changes. I'm saying that the change is not important. Yeah. No. Why? Why should they split? There is no spin interaction. Yeah, but there is no level split. The point is that there is no. They will change if there is magnetic interactions. There is no such thing. They will be shifting only because the action itself has no. It's a boson. There is no spin. So there is no spin interaction. Yes. Yeah, it will lead. No, splitting. Yes, I'm not worried about splitting. Why? It will shift the energy. No, but it doesn't split. No, of course. But the point is, it doesn't split. Yes, it's very small. Yeah. 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 Yes. Oh, if you have a continuum state. No, it's not. We can. I don't think that happens. So. Yes. But the point. I agree with that. Okay. I don't think that happens. The point is that the transition. You can consider the interaction. That interaction is suppressed. Because the transition rate is very small. I mean, the coupling between the different states is very small. There's just one state. They occupy one state. One state. not any other state. That's the key point. If you had these particles spread over 10 different states, that would be an issue. But now this doesn't happen, because the way the dynamics work, this does not happen. Does that? So let me continue. So we've gone over time, actually. No, but what he's asking about coherence. He's asking about coherence. No, but the shift will be very small. So the point is that this. I don't think it does in the end. No, because even if it's incoherent, you can imagine you do time correlated measure. No, as long as the spread. So because you'll do scanning. We are assuming here that the frequency, as long as I should tell you, as long as the spread in frequencies is smaller than the natural line width, which for the line width here, there is a 1 over Q, right? So there is a quality factor, which is if Q effective is 10 to the minus 3 or something, 10 to the 3. So there is a natural width in frequency for whatever line you detect that's set by the quality factor. So as long as that width is smaller than 10 to the minus 3, which I think it is, because I don't know of any numbers that would create that type of shift, then you have the power in one frequency, essentially. Okay? So this is a summary. but right now we've gone way over time, I think. So the summary is that you can get great sensitivity above 30 kilohertz with this setup. I should say that this setup is a much smaller size than LIGO, 40 times smaller. I should say here that I think gravitational waves are actually the future, because there is advanced LIGO that promises to detect gravitational waves very soon. There are several proposals out there. And it will be looking at the universe through a new eye, a new type of eye. So who knows what we'll find. So it's worth exploring all the frequency range that we can, even if we naively think that there are no astrophysical objects that are there. So I will end here without going to quantum craziness, because we've gone way over time. So thank you. Okay, let's go. So what I was going to talk about is, so as I said in the beginning, there are several proposals that say that you can imagine you can cool an object of 10 to the 8 and 10 to the 9 atoms down to the grand state of motion. So the question is, can we imagine that we take this ground state of motion and we take a macroscopic Schrödinger ground state? Can we create a state here, a superposition of state here and state there? And there are several groups that work around the world towards this. There is Arndt's group in Austria, I think they're based in Austria, where they've interfered a macroscopic, they've created an interferometer out of big protein molecules that has 430 atoms. This is the formula. And they see, actually, this is the interference fringe that they observe. So it's a very neat idea after that. So they take, the way they create their beam is very simple. They have a furnace that heats up these molecules. They have a little hole and molecules come out. And they have a grating. Part of it is mechanical, part of it is light as well. And the cool thing is they do what is called near field interferometry. Usually when you look at optics books, you assume your screen is at infinity and you get these nice fringes. But there is another type of interferometry that happens that when you look at very close to the screen, and there you get essentially kind of like the shadow of your screen, you get interference fringes that are separated by the screen width, distance between the screen slits. So here this is something that has a 200 micron screen slits. And they create, even though they start from a very coherent state, because this is a gas, right? They have the momentum distribution is crazy. They use the gradients to create state coherence. So they use the gradients to create state coherence. After the second gradient, they get an interference pattern. And they've done this, and they've actually even observed how it varies with the temperature of the gas. So they see that, because now what happens is these molecules have intervibrational modes, so the hotter they get, the more black body radiation they radiate. And they start, and they decohere faster. So they see, as a function of the internal temperature, they see that their contrast goes down as the. So now, but I should say, they start from a very thermal distribution. In this stage, you have your center of mass motion cooled down to microkelvin temperatures. So you have very good control of your initial state. So can you use it to do something useful? And the first question, of course, everyone asks, what about the coherence? And you can divide the coherence in two regimes. One is the regime where, so the coherence means interaction. So what you care about is the wavelength of the probe that has that does the decoherence. So if that wavelength is much larger than the separation between the two parts of the wave function, you have to wait the coherence time scale. You have to wait till you emit n particles so that this condition is satisfied. So that this so you actually measure essentially this distance delta x. But if the wavelength of your probe is much smaller than the wave function separation, a single interaction is enough to decohere the state. And the decoherence time scale is set by the interaction rate, but the single interaction rate. And the important thing to remember is if you have this object, this macroscopic of 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 atoms, the point is as and the internal modes have some thermal occupation number. But as long as they remain unchanged during the duration of the experiment, you don't have to worry about that. So what are the main sources of decoherence for this for the setups that I was for this optically trapped objects? One is, again, because they have internal vibrational modes, is the black body radiation emitted or absorbed by the walls of your experiment. You have collisions with background gas molecules, and you also have interaction with you can have interaction with whatever you use to hold and manipulate the state, the light, everything. In principle, the last one is controllable because it depends on your setup. Also, collisions with gas molecules are controllable because you can, if you go to a pressure of 10 to the minus 10 torr, it's easy to have for something that has 100 nanometer in size, you have collisions less than 1 per second. The main background, though, is that's irreducible because no matter what you do, the moment you hold something with light, because of absorption, you will heat it up. Is black body radiation emission from the object itself. The cool thing about this, though, is that the wavelength of the radiation emitted is much larger than the separation you hope to achieve. So for room temperature, this wavelength is roughly like 7 microns, while the separations that we're going to, wave function separation, are of order of nanometers, of tens of nanometers. And in fact, this is a plot that shows that calculates the decoherence time scale as a function of the internal temperature of the object. This is a 50 nanometer sphere that has a 0.1 nanometer separation. And as you can see, it's easy to get something of order of tens of milliseconds. And the point is that for these experiments, 10 milliseconds is a very long time. So you can use this to actually to hope to design a type of experiment. I should say, though, now that there is no experimentally feasible setup yet. And this is something, as far as we know, there are several proposals out there, but we think there are several issues with them in a way that cannot be used to do any type of interferometer for fundamental physics or gravity wave detection. So this is something that we're thinking about, to see how you can use this very well, once you achieve ground state cooling, how you can manipulate this state using light pulses. This is what we're thinking. To separate the state and recombine it, so that create a matter wave interferometer out of an object with 10 to the 8 atoms. So this is it. And So I think these techniques are very promising. They've proven very fruitful in other aspects of physics, like atomic physics and molecular physics. And I think there is a new field opening in the, for even bigger objects, macroscopic objects. So the question is, what is the limit? And I've presented a few things, and hopefully there are more on the way. So thank you. Yes? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Now the question is, how do you? You've asked me this question before, but it's okay. So there are two things. First of all, for the QCD action in particular, because the mass only turns on at the QCD phase transition. Because of the this is when the QCD instant, there is late entropy production. So the scaling with the phase is rather complicated, and it turns out it actually helps. So even at the phase of MGAT, the theta initial that you need is like, instead of order one, is like 3%. Now, so that means, to give all the dark matter. So you, to give the right value of dark matter. So it looks like it's tuned at a 3% level. And then it grows like the square root of a phi, roughly, the tuning. Now, in inflation, and we'll come back to that, I know you don't like it, but I think even in what you're thinking about, there may be a similar scanning, and I'll tell you why. So the point is that during inflation, during any period, let's assume that you have a period where the universe is, let's call it this. Sure. Over close. But I don't think it's a problem. First of all, that happens at around the phi of 10 to the 12. But the point is that even of a phi of MGAT, it looks like a 3% tuning. And there are other 3% tunings in nature. So you can say, well, that's something that we tolerate. I mean, people. Oh, maybe it's lower FA. I mean, the range of FA, who knows what the range of FA is? Maybe it's something that the ADMX will find. It doesn't say, I think it will be more interesting if you do find it, right? If you don't find it, because the action parameter space, for me, it's an open question. It's, naively, can be anything from 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 18, okay? Naively, that's the parameter space theoretically. Yeah, and that's already excluded. Yeah, that's already excluded by astrophysical observation, but, so, yes, it would overclose. Do I have any prejudice? If you don't find, the gut scale is well motivated. So that's the only reason. Yes, but there could be a mechanism that scans the initial conditions. This can happen naturally during inflation without invoking ever the landscape. And I think it may also happen in what you're considering. The point is that if you have a field, a scalar field, that's frozen in the universe somehow, it will have jumps of order Hubble, every Hubble time. So if you have enough time, if you have high enough scales of Hubble, and you are CC-dominated for long enough time, you automatically scan on the parameter range. So you automatically have a so-called landscape from whatever framework made sure initially your universe was flat. So you naturally will find. Yeah, exactly. So we'll find ourselves in a region we naturally have to find. It's anthropic. Yeah, in a sense. Yes. No, because, I mean, even in string. Oh, no, it's not evidence against. The problem is with the. No, we can discuss this later. No, but. Okay. can talk about it later. I don't mind talking about this. It's fine. There are several. No, I think it's an interesting conversation. Don't think, but in a sense, yeah. If you find an axion in this case, it means that you have some type of tuning in the initial conditions. Now the question is, maybe the tuning may be accidental, because if it's 3% for a phi of MGAT, it's not. I mean, we know other places in physics where 3% we've seen before. So you may say, well, that's another accident. But if it's closer to 10 to 17, it's 1%. Okay, then it starts getting uncomfortable. If you have some other type of axion where there's no the same effect that you have for the QCD axion, where the mass does not turn on late, then the tuning, I think, it's a bit higher. So then you can say more definitely. But yeah, I think if you find it there, it's evidence for some tuning. Yeah. Ah, no. There is a cute thing. So if there is a bit of a mystery about the black hole, how black holes grow. So for example, they need large seeds, relatively large seeds of black holes in order to get, the point is that if you have an axion, so if you, let's say you have a stellar mass and you have an axion, at some point of the growth of the black hole, it goes through a period where it's not fastly rotating. And non-fastly, sparse black holes eat faster than Kerr black holes, the fastly rotating black holes. So they grow faster. So you end up with an enhanced mass at the end after a certain period. So they can actually help with the growth of the black hole. So you don't need such high mass initial seeds in order to get the black holes that you observe today. Not necessarily. So the point is that as a black hole, the question is, if you, in order to get the 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 black hole mass black holes that you have at the center of the galaxy, you have to start off with something that's, say, 100 solar masses. And they were like, okay, how do you get this? But the point is that most of the black holes are rotating pretty fast. And the reason is all the stuff rotates. From the collapse, it just accumulates, they acquire. But the point is, if they go through a period, let's say you have an axion that corresponds to a 10 solar mass black hole or a 20 solar mass black hole. Forget about the QCD axion. That would be, let's go beyond the QCD axion. For the QCD axion, this is at the limit now. This would be an axion that's 10 to the 17 GeV, okay? That would do the effect. So you go through a period where you start to fastly rotate, then you meet where the action starts affecting you. Then you slow down to rotation. Then you can eat much more. So you eat more, then you grow. At some point, the action does not superradiate, so you lose the cloud, but you continue fastly rotating, and you end up with a fastly rotating black hole. This cannot be really tested, because the point is that these are very hard things to test. And the point is, yes, you grow with accretion, your spin grows, but some of the time there are stuff going this way that fall in you, and then there's stuff that goes the other way. So your spin, if you do simulations of black hole, the spin goes like that. So, I mean, who knows? The only way to test is to actually discover one. If you have an axion at a certain mass range, then you can actually say, well, they would affect the growth of black holes and the evolution. I think we stayed here enough.